But something has to be done about the media just posting and promoting and spreading lies.
What do you think?
It's like she sent me an article yesterday about the Atlantic article.
Suckers and Losers about veterans.
It was literally in 2020 is when it was written. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, that was just disproven. Jake Tapper even said it during the debate that it was disproven multiple times. I know we have the First Amendment, man, but like, you journalists have a right to tell the truth. And when you say that, that had a massive impact on things. Like, there's a lot of people that believe he said that.
Right.
And yeah, he didn't say it. And there's no recourse and there's no punishment for doing things like that that just have a massive impact on society and shape the opinion of Americans, you know. And it's like, this was based on a lie because you mm-hmm. hate the person you wrote the article about.
Well, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to I Came With Fire podcast. If you're new tonight to this episode, we are a bridge between the divide, trying to be a voice for objective truth and educated opinion. So welcome in. Thanks for giving us a follow. Thanks for checking us out. For our regular listeners, you'll see that Chris is not here tonight. Unfortunately, could not make it, but that's okay. We continue. So we are here tonight for the second time with Baker Levitt, the Director for Strategic Relationships at Black Rifle Coffee. Thanks for coming back on, Baker. I appreciate it. Last time was a good conversation under much different pretenses, for sure. We were talking about the election, which thankfully went the way we were hoping it did. But welcome back on the show. Thank you again.
Yeah, man. Glad to be back. Yeah, dude, that was leading up to that election, man. Like, you know, it's funny when you have people that like predict stuff and like on the inside that know what's going on, like inside baseball information. And like some of them are like, oh my God, we're going to sweep all seven swing states. And you're just kind of like, is that what you want to happen? Or is that really what the tea leaves that you're reading are saying? And, you know, it's normally the people that were like, oh, we're going to sweep all seven are like usually like my most emotional friends, but they're also some of my most dialed in friends. And it was pretty interesting because they were right, man. I hit the sack at like 11 p.m. election night. I was like, dude, it's over. Like, it is over.
Yeah. Right.
And which was great, but now what are they doing? You know, like what are they doing with all the power we have, supposed to have the Supreme Court conservative majority? It felt that way leading up to the election. It doesn't really feel like that right now. We have the Senate. I'm not going to say anything negative about them, but I don't really have anything positive to say other than they're getting a lot of Trump's nominees through. Which I'd love to speak about Jared Isaacman, who's the NASA nominee. He's awesome. Yeah. And then the House, no clue what they're doing. Literally no clue. And then the nominees that we've pushed through so far, I don't know what they're doing, but I do know they're doing a lot of selfies. And they're posting a lot of selfies, and they're a lot of footage of them walking from a black SUV onto a plane, which I don't know where they're going, and I don't know why I need to know that. I don't care. It's like,
yes.
And then,
no, I agree.
It's annoying. And then you see Hegseth. It's like, okay, you're working out with the troops. Fitness is good, but that's not something that I particularly care about that you're doing. I don't, you know. And then, like, you know, Bongino, whom he hasn't been there long enough for me really to bust his chops, but like, he needs a new comm guy because his tweets are, in my opinion, are just so pointless and stupid. It's like, hey man, like, it's like I tell people regarding social media, like, if you don't have anything to say, don't say anything.
Don't say it.
You know, like, bad day to be a bad guy. I don't want to see that anymore. I don't care. I don't care. That doesn't mean anything. Like, just give us like transparency, like give us the steak. We don't need the salad. We don't need the appetizer. Like, let's just give us the beef. Like, we want to know what's going on. And if there's nothing going on, man, just be like, yeah, we, you know, can't talk about what we're doing right now. It's, you know, ongoing investigation or classified or whatever the term is. But like, let's. And then Kristen Noem, lady, you 95-pound little woman, what are you doing? Like,
oh yeah, kid it up.
You're an administrator. You're cosplaying as an operator. That is not what. That's not your job. And then that picture of her with
that, we call that a dog and pony.
That
show.
Picture of her with that AR. It's like, She looked like a 22-year-old guy that just realized he's not going to get to go play in the NFL. And his wife just had a kid, and he's holding the child in a very awkward way. You know, it's like some dude that's about to deploy. That's like, wife just had a kid. And he's like, what is this?
The FNG.
I don't know how to hold this. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. No, I agree completely. I actually, we had this conversation on our podcast not that long ago about pulling in all these social media influencers, and I kind of saw like the direction they were trying to go with this, but a lot of these guys have made their money on those pointless tweets, like you've said. They're left open to be ambiguous. People are going to react to them really hardcore, and I sort of think they've taken a lot of these people, like Bongino and a couple others, who they really rode the backs on last year, and have tried to pull them in to, I guess, sort of commit to that alternative media thing, and then also like as a throw to the transparency thing, but it hasn't really gone very well. And in fact, even the biggest flop so far was the Epstein files thing, where they brought in all those guys, the whole Bindergate thing, and that was a total disaster because Pam Bondi, right before that, had gone on Twitter and said, "I've got this on my desk, and it's terrible what's in here." So either she didn't look at the files that she was given, and there was a total lie on X anyway, or she did and knew that it was nothing new, and she just made up some BS tweet. She's one that I'm really not happy with, but I totally agree. The pointless tweets, nothing. You don't need to get on and provide to me fluff. Like, we talk about this in the military a lot about fluff. The photo ops, like the Christy Noem thing, totally pointless. I don't need to see you out there kitted up. If you want to get out there, they're politicians. They're going to get a photo op. Go out there. You don't need to razzle dazzle me. I'm not impressed with you wearing kit. You weren't even wearing it right in the first place.
You didn't have plate carrier.
Right. That's it. I don't need to see all that. Go out there. You want to get your photo op, you know, show that you're committed to it. That's going to happen. I don't need the show. I also don't need, the Bindergate thing, any of this stuff that's just fluff. If whatever it is, facts wise, are going to speak for themselves, they're going to stand up on their own. Anything else like this, like you mentioned, the working out stuff, the photo ops, the Fox News attendance. I think a lot of these picks have been pretty underwhelming for me as well.
The Epstein thing with Bondi, like, I have absolutely no doubt in my mind that she is a very capable attorney when it comes to like, hey, this is the case that you're running. You're going to handle these 10 cases. I'm sure she's good at that. But like, lady, listen, my divorce many, many years ago, in 2010,
okay,
was the most painless divorce in the history of divorces. Like, we didn't fight. We were just like, we shouldn't have gotten married. We made a mistake. I care about you as a person. I care about you as a person. Let's go our separate ways. That was 200 pages of paperwork. Right. That simple right. divorce. And you're telling me that one of the most insane legal cases in the history of our country, mm-hmm. with hundreds and hundreds of witnesses that span the Atlantic and Pacific Ocean
for decades,
you're going to tell me that that was 200 pages? You know what those people looked like in front of the White House holding their binders up? Like a family in the late 80s that had just bought a timeshare in Mexico. And they were standing in front of the building where they got their timeshare holding their three-ring binders. Like a family from Ohio or something. You know, like...
Well, there's just more... The binder thing, too. They put on their most transparent presidency in history or something like that. That's just more of that fluff that's absolutely unnecessary. You don't need to put anything like that. You don't need to take what happened, something that disgusting, serious, and evil, and have some sort of catchphrase on the front of the binder about being transparent. You know, if it was actually the files, the transparency would speak for itself, right? And I agree with you as far as the decades that this has been going on, the hundreds and hundreds of people, probably thousands of people that have been involved in this across multiple departments, right, of people who are investigating, different attorneys general, all of these things. You know, it's very obvious to me, I think, and having done casework for almost two decades, that a lot of this stuff is gone. And they need to say that, and needed to say that. A lot of the investigation files have been gone. Court documents, those are things that are going to be gone. And right now, I don't even think they could come out and say anything that people would trust.
Well, they can't.
That whole stunt.
The thing that's unfortunate is they can't talk about it because Ghislaine Maxwell's case is going before the Supreme Court. So it's an ongoing investigation. Yeah. But that should have been if that had been disclosed in the very beginning, day one, I think everyone would have been, okay, cool, we can wait it out. Like, you know, there's a reason behind it, but like 200 whole pages? 200 pages.
Yeah, no.
That's crazy. Cash Patel, not super stoked on. Like, he ran this whopper of a PR campaign. He did the podcast tour and absolutely beat the drums. It's probably one of the best communications campaigns, brand building campaigns I've ever seen. It was incredible. He said everything he said was the right thing. Now, do I want him to go and do all of that? No, I don't want him to turn the FBI into a museum. That's absurd. No,
I agree.
There's ongoing cases. There's all kinds of stuff going on, but. Oh, yeah. I mean, hey man, like, what are you doing? You know, like, and listen, dude, I'm not like an eye for an eye guy. Like, I'm not the guy that's out there like, you've got to bust the Democrats' asses because they busted our asses. I'm not calling for that. But like, my thing is like, if you say and you run on doing this and that and all these things, at least do something, you know, or be like, hey guys, I can't discuss this because this is going on or whatever, but like, it's just like, you know, rah rah sis boom bah, and then all of a sudden they get in office and we don't hear anything and nothing happens. And I gotta turn a light off, it's kind of blinding me. Hold on one second, I apologize.
No, you're good.
Oh, that's 500 times better.
Hell yeah. So just sort of says to me that they didn't learn the lesson from even the last 4 years, when really the lesson here has been, you know, you could pay attention over the past even 15 years and have learned this lesson, but especially over the last 4 years under the Biden admin, just how much they controlled the media and the things they said were always untrue. Even if it was right in your face that it was untrue, and coming out and like the campaign you just talked about, the communications campaign, you don't need to say all this stuff if it's not going to happen. I don't want that anymore. And I think a lot of people are sick and tired of the fluff, to keep using that word, from politicians, from people who are trying to hold offices, bureaucrats, whatever it is. And a lot of people who voted for Trump this time are from the middle. These are the people that are sick and tired of and fed up of being saying I want to be left alone and watching what happens. And those are the same sorts of people who don't want to hear the fluff either. We just want to see results at this point. I think people are so fed up with the American political apparatus that nothing but results is going to do. And obviously there's going to be people who are contrarians on both sides. But I think that silent majority that, you know, Reagan has talked about in the past and that really showed up this election are the people who are going to be to take their vote elsewhere next time and in 2026 as well with midterms if they can't just let the results speak for themselves. You know, when people talk, you can give them, you know, they'll rope all the rope they need to hang themselves. I'm sure you've heard that before. And people will do it. This is the whole campaign about letting AOC talk. Just let her talk, right? That she's building the rope that'll hang herself. That's fine. But you don't need to give people the rope by saying egregious things, being ambiguous, not following through on your words with your actions. All of that is the same sort of thing that we've seen forever, and you promised to do differently. And I agree with you. There has been a considerable amount of letdown from that group of people.
Oh, yeah. They don't and then I have no idea what they're doing. I don't know what they're – I can't intelligently say – what they're working on, what they're doing, anything that I'm happy with so far. I mean, they freed Ross Ulbricht, got a pardon. That's a big deal. Said he was going to do that. Said they were going to establish a crypto, a Bitcoin strategic reserve. They completely and totally, from top to bottom, shit all up and down the whole crypto thing they were trying to do. Like, they made a mockery of it. That pisses me off because
why does it piss you off?
Large percent of my net worth is tied up in Bitcoin and Ethereum. Large percent. And they fumbled that and they're still fumbling it. And I don't think that they have a clue what they're doing regarding crypto. But I do have one little talking point I want to whiz over real quick. Give me one second. All right, so there's a push right now for price controls to put price controls in place. Those don't work. They have never worked. Going all the way back to the Roman Empire in 300 and 400.
Correct.
Diocletian
tried that. It failed. Yeah. Diocletian, yeah. The Roman Emperor.
Yeah,
Diocletian.
And that's basically the beginning of the downfall of Rome. Like, it failed miserably. It's never worked anywhere. Venezuela tried it and it failed there. Conservatives need to resist the temptation of European drug price controls. Like, we should absolutely fight tooth and nail to prevent that. The GOP has a historic opportunity to fix Medicaid by getting illegals out of Medicaid and establishing stronger work requirements. Having all the levers of the government in Republican control doesn't happen very often. These price controls, they will not fix Medicaid. It's basically political malpractice as far as I'm concerned. When this fails, and it will fail, the GOP will have to answer to voters why they didn't get rid of waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid. Seems like there is some staff, bunch of staff, around the president who are giving him bad counsel, and I believe that this is horrible, horrible policy. Folks listening should call their members of Congress and get them to stop this effort dead in its tracks. Post about it, raise hell, call your congressman. Lose your mind. Do not let them put price controls in place, especially on pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. Two things with that, right? So you talked about bad counsel. The one that gets me the most is the whole Laura Loomer thing. I don't understand that. You know, when you look back through presidencies, and even just like world leaders in general, a lot of people like that have kept around some odd characters for counsel. You know, another one that comes to mind right away is like Rasputin, right? Like, obviously she's not Rasputin, but he's somebody who comes to mind. It doesn't make any sense to me. What is quantifying having her around to give him advice? I don't see that, right? And then go ahead.
No, you keep going.
I was going to say, it doesn't make any sense to me. Most people, even on the right, I think, feel he's making a massive mistake keeping her around, especially giving her kudos for her counsel and having her there at the White House. And then the whole narrative behind the reason why somebody lost their job. I can't remember who it was.
A handful of people on the National Security Council.
Right.
So if you look listen, I have been a vocal critic of Laura Loomer. My cousin Lizzie and her mother are flaming, flaming progressives. And I fight with them every other day. And she was like, Laura Loomer this, Laura Loomer that. And like, I was like right there, like, why is she hanging around the president during the campaign? I did not like it at all.
Yeah.
And then I saw what she did, like exposing those people on the National Security Council. So the way I would describe her is there is a person that 95% of the time you don't understand why they're on the team. Why have we not fired this person? Why have we not kicked him off of our team?
Sure.
They just cause problems. And every once in a while, there's a cave. Somebody's got to go in that cave. And that's the person that goes in the cave. So, and where I got that analogy from, Chris Irwin, who I worked with for many years at Killcliff, he was a Gold Squad guy. And we had a mutual friend named Dan Cirillo, Taco. He was a SEAL. Taco passed away like 2 years ago of a heart attack, 51 years old. But he was a crazy bastard. And like always in, he's the guy that was always in trouble, you know, like getting investigated, all this shit, all kinds of crazy stuff. And I said, Irwin, how does a guy like Taco stay on a SEAL team? And he said, Baker, you keep guys like that around because every once in a while there's a cave and somebody's got to go in that cave. And they're the guy that you don't have to ask to go in the cave. They're already in there doing the job. And so when I think about Laura Loomer, that's what I think about. I don't want her coming after me. Okay. And I would never want her, someone like that coming after me. Like if I was in a position of power or whatever. I'm not scared of Laura Loomer. I'm not saying I'm scared of her, but like, you see what I'm saying? She's a scalpel that on one end is a scalpel and on the other end of the tool is like a two-headed, like one half is a sledgehammer, the other half is a battle axe. And it's a lot easier to swing the battle axe and the hammer and destroy everything because there's all the weights on that end of the tool. But every once in a while, she uses that scalpel as well as anyone in all of the media. So she's one of those she serves a purpose, man. And like, if you look at all the shit she's done and said and fights she's picked online and all that, what she did on the National Security Council erases everything as far as I'm concerned. Like she went in and like, I mean, if you look at what happened to that National Security Council since she met with the president and like gave him a bunch of information. Waltz is no longer head of the Security Council. A bunch of Biden holdovers whom Waltz kept on were let go like the afternoon that she left. She has an ability to dig and research and do oppo research with the best of them. The problem is that Laura Loomer tends to fight within the party. She attacks people within the party.
Sure.
Which is frustrating as a Republican. You know, it's like, what are you doing? Why are you attacking our own? But then again, like I said, dude, every once in a while, man, she's going to come in with that scalpel and she's going to cut and then she's going to crash and smash shit. And then she's going to slice and smash. So she's valuable, man. But like, I don't like her style. I can't stand it. I hate the gaslighting. I hate the accusations. I hate the hell raising. But every once in a while, man, like,
you're a business guy, right? Yeah. So you called her a scalpel. And on the other end, you said a battle axe and a sledgehammer. Yeah. But a scalpel is what we're talking about. What qualities, right, even from your vantage point as a businessman, does somebody that's a scalpel have that make them necessary?
So I'm glad you asked me that question. So I'm a director at Black Rifle. I've been there a decade. I also have a consulting firm that does consulting for a ton of companies, a lot of stuff in DC, like a tremendous amount of work in DC. And what was your question again?
What qualities does somebody that's a scalpel, to use your analogy, have, and why does that make them necessary?
Sidetracked. I lose my thought all the time.
You're good. Yeah, I feel you.
My consulting company in DC, I have the ability to make dreams come true. I'm giving you A to work with. The desired outcome is C. So A plus B equals C. Right, you don't get to ask me what happens in B, the black box, because that's none of your business. That's what I do. And most of the time, I don't even know how the hell I get things done. I just know that I'm going to figure it out and we'll get it done. So you give me A to work with, B happens, and then the outcome is C. That's what you want. So your dream is coming true. I also have the ability. You know, like when you have a bad dream and you wake up in the middle of the night and instantaneously you're like, thank God that was a dream. I have the ability to make you wake up and go, oh shit, this isn't a dream. This is reality. So that's when you would use a scalpel. Very rarely are scalpels used like for good, I would say, like on the, the promotion side, like rah, rah, sis, boom, bah, like Jared Isaacman, he's awesome. Okay.
Yeah.
The guy that nominated to lead NASA, like great dude.
Correct.
And we'll get to that. I love talking about him. That's one of those situations where like you would never, there's no need to use a scalpel. Whereas an example of using a scalpel, like Laura Loomer, would be, I have someone putting that, I have someone that's a rhino that isn't going to vote in a confirmation hearing the way that I want them to. Okay.
Yes.
So like Corinne, he was a holdout on some of the previous, and Tom Tillis was a question mark. And Bondi, not Bondi, the woman from Iowa.
Her name escapes me.
Joni Ernst. They were holdouts on some of the early confirmation hearings, okay? So you'd use a scalpel there, and you'd start a subtle oppo campaign. You'd do, start doing a little digging. Sprinkle a little bit of, you know, dingleberries out there. Like, ooh, look what I, did you know that this individual does this and this and this? Scalpels are fun, dude. Like, they're, of all the tools in the toolbox, man, like, when you go for the scalpel and it, you're doing it for good, like, you're using the scalpel to do something negative to a bad person or a person who deserves it. That's a rush. Like, we're going to shake the tree today, and we're going to shake it tomorrow, and we're going to keep shaking that tree until we get exactly what we want falling out of it. And that's when you use a scalpel. So like a, like Laura Loomer, like I'm going to make something up here.
Yes.
Let's say I've got some individuals in FEMA that are holding up getting aid to North Carolina. Okay.
Okay.
And I know who they are. And I know that there's Biden holdouts in FEMA and they're causing a bottleneck. Okay.
Right.
And I got to bring attention to that bottleneck and to them. So like it kind of ties in. So I need to solve this problem today to get aid to the people of Western North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I can, my goal is to get the aid there, or is my goal to fire and cause trouble for the people holding it up? Goal one, immediate problem to solve is getting aid released. That's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, the people causing it for the wrong reasons, I want to cause them a lot of problems. So 1A is first, and then there's 1B. Okay, then you go after 1B, but your focus is to open up that bottleneck. That's when you use a scalpel.
That makes sense.
And like and
the analogy,
the best thing in the world, dude, is cutting them loose.
Right.
Like guns hot, guns free, go for it. Whatever you want to do and say, but you can't. But it can't track back to.
I'll look the other way. Client. Correct. Yeah, no, the analogy that comes to my mind here is it's just like talking about conventional versus special forces guys. Like those are the ones that are, those are your scalpel, right? You need something done, weird, figure it out. They're going to do it. They're, you know, creative and ingenious. Like they'll do it. Like that's exactly. So that's a, I think that's a good way to look at it because you need those people. I think a lot of high performers in business, and I'm not a businessman, certainly not to the degree that you are, but high performers in both of those arenas, I think have a lot of, qualities in common, especially thought processes and the way they view problems. I don't think that most people in those spots view problems as anything other than just an obstacle and not a stopping force. Like, they're the forcing function behind getting something done, whatever that looks like. And, you know, I like the way that you've framed that, because that's necessary, especially when you are somebody like the president who does not have like absolute authority, right, to do everything. You are part of a triple tiered branches of government. You need people like that. So I think that the analogy there is
sufficient. Yeah, it's like you have a river running through your property. And like, yeah, you live in Florida, it's hot, you spend the winters, you know, up in the mountains, and you come back and your river's dry. Like, what the hell? Like, all my pastures are screwed up. Blah, 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 blah. It's like, well, a beaver dammed it. Okay. I have two problems. I've got to irrigate my fields and fix that. But the problem today is getting the water flowing. So I'm going to go blow this beaver dam, and then I'll solve my other problem. It's very rare, man, that problems, you just solve them and move on to the next thing. I mean, and honestly, that is honest to Christ what Elon Musk's greatest skill is identifying a problem, the biggest problem a company has, and solving it. And he goes and he sits down with the line engineers until the problem is solved. He doesn't go through the managers. He goes to the source of the problem. Who's line is that? And he works directly with the engineers. They sleep at the office until the problem is solved. I'm talking line engineers. He doesn't go through a chain of command. He goes directly to the source. He is the greatest person in the history of business at identifying bottleneck problems and solving them. That is his superpower. It is remarkable, truly remarkable. So, high achievers – like, high performers don't like being around low achievers. And low achievers don't like being around high performance people. So, the thing, and the administration is so big and so complex, but you got your lead bus, the president's on that bus. You just have to make sure you have the right people on the bus in the right seats on the bus. And then you can do anything, you can accomplish anything. And another guy, Peter Navarro. Holy shit. Don't ever take economic advice. And for every person listening, do not ever take advice from an academic, because academics, especially PhDs, have the benefit of hindsight. And all they do is study things that other people have done and talk about the mistakes they made. It's like being an armchair quarterback on a Monday and be like, oh, man, you shouldn't have gone for it on 4th-and-2. Well, no shit.
Right.
It didn't work.
Yeah, it didn't work.
If it had worked, what would you have said? Oh, that's a great call. So, Peter Navarro, that guy, Harvard MBA, PhD, Harvard professor, PhD in economics. It's like, what have you done, though? Like, what have you experienced in real time other than studying history of other people's businesses and the economy? Dude. Anyway, I want to talk about a guy that Trump nominated that's the baddest sumbitch out there. All right.
Fair enough.
So, when is this going to publish, you think?
I could publish it later this week. Maybe I can get to you, or Saturday we have one dropping. I could do Monday. That's
fine. So, Friday I get on a plane to go to Bozeman, Montana, and I'm going to be flying around in MiGs on Saturday with Jared Isaacman, who is the nominee to lead NASA. He had his confirmation hearing 3 weeks ago, I think, two or 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. He came out of committee, and then they went on break. He came out of committee last Wednesday, 21-7. He'll go before the full Senate for his confirmation, hopefully in May at the latest, the first week of June. Hopefully they get him in before the Memorial Day break. I'm going to tell you a story about what qualification looks like. we've talked about people that we don't, aren't doing a good job, aren't qualified. You know, you made the comment they're social media personalities, you know, and all that stuff. And I can't stand Peter DeBoer. All the other people, I don't like their style right now, but we're 100 days in. We'll see what happens. You know, I'm giving benefit of the doubt. Peter DeBoer, I can't stand. Like, I hate academics. I can't stand them. All right. So anyway.
Right.
So Jared Isaacman is the nominee to lead NASA. Okay. He dropped out of high school when he was 15 years old because he thought, I have to raise my hand to ask permission to go to the bathroom. That's absurd. Drops out of high school.
Yes.
Learns to code in his parents' basement. Okay. And starts a credit card processing company when he's 15 years old. Started doing like millions of dollars in credit card processing payments. Like, he would have meetings at his house and like have to have like an adult sit in, and he would like hide in the basement because no one was going to sit down and meet with a 15-year-old and take him seriously. Crazy That's stuff. Wild. All right. So when he was 16, he told his dad, he's like, I've got to have an outlet other than this company, because like there has to be more to me than just this. His dad's like, why don't you like take a flying lesson or something? Because the kid was always obsessed with outer space and whatnot. So he takes a flying lesson and goes up first lesson in a Cessna, and he lands and he goes, this is it. This is what I want to do. So he builds this massive, and what I'm telling you now has happened simultaneously throughout his life. So he builds a massive credit card processing company called Shift4. Shift4 does about $200 billion with a B dollars a year in credit card processing. $200 billion. So think about how big that company is. Okay. So administratively, you're like, oh, this guy qualifies. All right. He's qualified for the job. He's run a huge company. Yeah. But his true passion was flying. And so he's flying. He goes to Embry-Riddle, gets a degree in aeronautical engineering, aerospace science, something like that. One of those. Starts flying, buying planes because he's making a bunch of money. He's obsessed with flying. Buys his first foreign fighter jet. And, you know, he's whipping all over the place and ends up setting the world record for circumnavigating the globe in a fighter jet. 61 hours.
Oh, wow.
Did it on his third try. So he's got drive. Okay.
That's awesome.
So he ends up starting a company called Draken International. And Draken International is the largest fleet of privately owned foreign fighter jets. So they do all the Op 4 opposing force stuff with the U.S. Air Force, Navy, and the Marine Corps.
Sure.
All right. He's got 7,000 hours in a cockpit. Like, it's completely wild. All right. They had a demo team. Like, he does it all. All right. All right. So he's qualified as a pilot operationally for the job to lead NASA. Okay. All right. But he's always been obsessed with outer space, man. Okay. And in 2018, I think, is the year that Elon Musk said whoever raises the most money for St. Jude's gets to go up in a SpaceX launch. So he strokes a check for $100 million. And says, did I win? They're like, yeah, you won. So he does I don't remember the name of the mission, but he goes up and does a mission where they're in outer space for like 3 or 4 days. Truly outer space. And there's a Netflix documentary. So he does another space mission called Polaris Dawn. Now, Polaris Dawn, there's a Netflix documentary. I highly recommend watching it. It's really, really cool. All right. So he does a Polaris Dawn mission. He's the first civilian astronaut to ever do a spacewalk.
Yeah.
So, dude, 732 miles above the surface of the Earth, going 25,000 miles an hour.
Katy Perry could only imagine.
Just what dreams are made of. And she inspires us to be the best version of ourselves. So,
indeed.
He's got, I think, 8 days total in outer space. Okay. Mm-hmm. Also, Draken and has done government contracts with SpaceX and the U.S. military, Department of Defense, in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So this guy qualifies from an administrative standpoint. He qualifies from a government contract and procurement standpoint. He qualifies intellectually, obviously, because he's smart as hell. And he qualifies from an operational standpoint because he is a civilian. He's an astronaut. There is no other person in Donald Trump's administration that checks every single possible box. Oh, and by the way, he's only 42.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, dude. So, I mean, just an absolute rock star of a human being. So he's taking me up in his MiG, one of his MiGs, Saturday.
That's badass.
It's cool. I'm not excited.
No, why not?
I have zero interest in fighters. I mean, like, I like to look at them, but like, I'm pretty broad shouldered, you know.
Have you been to Bozeman before?
Yeah, I get a little claustrophobic, you know, and like, I'm the guy that's like, hey man, it's time to land. If you don't land, I'm gonna pull this ripcord. I'm getting out of here. I can't handle this shit.
Right, we're all getting out of here.
No, yeah. I'll be fine. There's a big group of us going. It's gonna be awesome. I don't know if I'm gonna go up. Like if Travis Pastrana's going with us and like he's obsessed with fighter jets and stuff.
Dude.
So like if I could give up my seat for him to get another spin in a fighter jet, I'd do that in a New York minute. Just because like, dude, I don't know, man. It just being there and watching my friends do it and like checking out the MiGs and stuff, like I think that'll be super cool. But it's just not something that I'm
not your
bad. Yeah, I mean, so, dude, like he flew down to Salt Lake from Bozeman in his jet. His private jet picked up Evan Hafer 2 weeks ago, flew Evan back to Bozeman. They got out, threw Evan in a flight suit and threw his ass in a MiG and whipped him around Bozeman for a couple hours. And Evan, they were flying in formation, like tip to tip.
Dude, that's wild.
And Evan said, he goes, dude, he goes, I was going to kill you when I landed. And then I was going to fire you. He's like, if I could have gotten Wi-Fi or a cell signal while I was in that plane, I'd have fired you on the spot. And I was like, why? He goes, dude, we were flying in formation and like we were tip to tip. And he's like, I've never been so nervous and uncomfortable in my entire life. And he was like, but once they pulled away, he was like, it was great. He goes, I'm not going to fire Baker. I love Baker. He's like, but he's like, it was nerve-wracking. Well, like his like survival instinct is incredibly high, self-preservation mechanism.
Yeah.
It just rattled him a little bit. But like, Travis Pastrana and JT Guerrero will be there. Like those dudes are like, oh my god, more. It's just not my thing.
Yeah, adrenaline junkies.
Yeah, they love it. So, but anyway, yeah, I'm stoked. He's going to be awesome. The whole thing with like NASA and make because like, dude, when I was a kid, man, like I turned 50 in August. When I was a kid, man, like astronauts were like heroes, man. Yeah. Like it inspired young boys and young girls to want to be great. Exactly. American exceptionalism, winning the space race, going to the moon, like beating the Russians, like that. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. And I personally think that that is worth, if we can elicit that response from our youth, it's worth $100 billion all day long, as far as I'm concerned, you know?
But no, I completely agree with you.
I think it's awesome. And I think Isaacman, that's his goal. That's what he wants to do. That's what he's going to do. Like, you know, like I said, high achiever, dude. Like, just get out there, get after it. High school dropout, 15 years old. Amazing.
Right. Well, it kind of goes back to what you were talking about with people and academics, right? The biggest difference between academics, in my mind, and people like Isaacman is doing and reading, right? It's like the line from Lord of the Rings is the world doesn't exist inside of your books, right? And that's one of the biggest things for me that proves competence is your ability to go out and do and trying as well, you know, like you're trying to do something and build something and be a part of something better. No, but being able to set the book down, you know, and being able to go out there and just say, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to learn how to do it. I'm going to be the very best at exactly what I'm doing, especially in an area where you don't have the skill or somebody holding your hand the whole time, like being 15 and going into your basement and learning how to code and designing something like a credit card processing system and becoming successful at that. Like, that's rare, first and foremost. But you talked, too, about American exceptionalism. And we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago on the podcast about William Knudsen. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I know that name.
So FDR, he was a private mogul as well, kind of like Isaacman or Elon Musk. But FDR hired him to take all of the factories in the United States during World War II and turn them into military manufacturing powerhouses to keep up with the war effort and both theaters, right? And it's just, that goes back to that scalpel thing that you were talking about before. He went in, don't care how you get from A to C, whatever B looks like, you need to do it. And he did it. And I think that that private industry aspect of America, first off, there's a big difference between what private industry looks like in the United States versus what private industry looks like in some place like China with the CCP, because innovation thrives in an environment where you're not hindering somebody, you're not telling them what to say, you're also not telling them your end product is now going to be mine. I've worked in the innovation space. I worked for Air Force Research Lab for a couple of years before I got to the Air Force, and those are some of the most like free environments I've ever worked in. So people like Musk, people like Isaacman, those are exactly the proof of what American exceptionalism can be. You know, the Cold War and all of that conversation about like the space race and the moon, like, yeah, absolutely, that inspired a generation of Americans. And I think we can do it again, especially if you are reaching out towards younger children, you know, kids, especially from somebody like Isaacman's standpoint, where he learned how to code and develop something that way that obviously appeals to the youth today. But the moon, space, like, that's still very relevant, right? So are you familiar with helium-3? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, going to the moon, being able to establish a base there, there's a race, you know, between us and the Chinese. The Chinese and the Russians say they're going to go back there. Like, these are all classic Cold War tropes coming right back, you know, now in our generation. Digging into the regolith of the moon, trying to take all of that energy from the helium-3, bring it back to the United States, use it. All of, these are things, there's so many different ways that you can go about trying to inspire a group of people into believing in going back in space is relevant. Asteroid mining, all of these things. You know, having somebody who came from seemingly nowhere and into a space like NASA or, you know, the government, I think just also shows to everybody else that you don't have to be a company man to go and become somebody like this to inspire a group of people. You can, on your own back and on your own merit, get somebody's attention, get a lot of people's attention, and do the work, and then basically be rewarded for it by being in charge of something like NASA and reigniting that flame that the United States was very proud to have for decades and bring that back to the United States. I think that's a missing piece to the United States. There's so many people that are so willing to hate on us as a country, especially Americans. Like, Americans' self-loathing is, I think, is stupid first and foremost. There's no problem with identifying problems and wanting to fix them, but there's a difference between that and being a self-loathing individual. But having somebody like Isaacman to sort of bring back that love of country, I think is an absolutely successful angle at doing it. It's happened before. All of that is still very, very relevant today. Space warfare is coming back, coming on the horizon, a militarizing space. Chinese and the United States are going after that as well. You know, so there's just so many different areas that he can inspire people to get involved in. So I think it's an absolute home run of a pick.
One other thing I want to talk about, and this will probably be a sore subject for some people, USAID.
Okay.
You know, there's a chapter in the Special Forces Handbook that said...
Oh, yeah. My co-host is a Green Beret. Right. He is very familiar with USAID.
What's that?
I said my co-host is a Green Beret. He's very familiar with USAID.
And I think a lot of the crazy... Like, there's... USAID, man, like, a lot of... Like, you know, I was saying we have a problem that we need to solve today. There's a dragon tail on that problem we'll deal with later, but right now we need to solve this problem. We can't worry about this problem, the problem in the future. We need to worry about the problem today at hand, okay? Mm-hmm. Because hypotheticals, you know, it's like, so like you see all that stuff like training, like $2 million for condoms in Gaza. That wasn't for condoms.
Yeah.
That wasn't for condoms.
Yeah.
What you had was some millennial shithead that was just being cute and putting absolutely absurd labels on what the aid was going for. And so, like, they're reporting, like, oh, it's for transgender yoga-making lessons in Burma. That's not what the money was for, man. And everyone's like, I can't believe we're spending money on that. It's like, that is not what it was used for.
Correct.
Probably used to pay off some warlord to keep stop him from attacking a base. Yeah. There's all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think they fell for that, and that's a little disappointing. Do I think there's a lot of fraud in USAID? Good heavens, yes. Do I think these NGOs are staffed by elected officials, nieces and nephews and sons and daughters? Yes. Do I think they're getting huge paychecks? Yes. However, I do think before you go getting rid of all of USAID, I think you need to take a long, hard look at what it actually does and learn a little bit about the history of it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I mean, are you familiar with John Perkins?
No, I'm not.
So John Perkins wrote a book, and he's rewritten a couple of different editions of it, but it's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Oh, yeah. I have that book. Yeah.
Okay. Have you read it? It's really, really fantastic. Good. It is, yeah. So in that, he talks about USAID quite a bit and all these other NGOs. Like one of the corporations that he worked for the most in South America was Texaco. And obviously Texaco isn't around anymore in that name, right? But listening to him talk about a lot of these, the history, to go back to what you were saying, of debt trap economy and the NGOs and USAID and all of the money that gets funneled into these special interest groups that make their way down there. They know they're not going down there to just take oil or resources out of these countries. They're going down there to burden these countries with so much debt that they'll never, ever be able to get out of it. And the money that these guys are coming with is to buy off politicians so that they agree to these contracts with the U.S. government. You know, that's the history of that. And if for anybody listening, if you have an interest in learning like the nitty gritty, really fucked up details about that stuff, I highly recommend the Economic Hitman book. But that's a great way to learn about the history there of that and just how much these non-governmental organizations and the CIA, right, have fucked over this half of the world specifically for decades. It's pretty wild. Yeah. So.
Tales of an Economic Hitman, dude. I read that book 10 years ago, maybe longer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty old. He's redone a couple of them. The newest one he's got has a whole section on the Chinese, right, in the BRI. So John Perkins. Yeah. I just talked about like the BRI as well, the Belt and Road Initiative, and how the Chinese market themselves and have marketed themselves differently. And, you know, using the mistakes the United States has made to sort of sell themselves as a better option. But in the end, it's still the same sort of debt trap diplomacy that a lot of these countries wind up in. And the infrastructure that's the one difference he really makes is a lot of the infrastructure that the United States was building for these countries, whatever roads, highways, manufacturing or energy plants or whatever was high quality. But the Chinese do not do high quality. There's the Coca Dam, I think is what it's called. It's in South America, one of the South American countries. I want to say it's either Ecuador. I think it is Ecuador. They built this dam and they built all this hydroelectric, systems and buildings and all of that to help the people out there. And it fell apart. It literally collapsed and crumbled, and all of the infrastructure, first off, it fell apart, and then all of the jobs that it created went away immediately. And that was how they were paying the interest off on these loans that the Chinese government gave them. And it happened in such a small period of time too, not even in like the really long, I guess, drawn out way that happened under the United States. But yeah, the updated version is really good if you have an interest in it. It talks about, you know, like I said, the Chinese, the Belt and Road Initiative, and just how much it's the same flavor of vanilla, as I like to say. And it's why so many of these countries, like you saw probably recently, India said that the BRICS currency is stupid. They won't have anything to do with it. I always viewed the BRICS currency as more like a Chuck E. Cheese token anyway. It's only good inside of Chuck E. Cheese, yeah. Right? And it's the same with BRICS. Even if it is gold-backed, no one's using it. Like the SWIFT system as well, which I know you're familiar with, and SIPs that the Chinese use. Well, there's trillions of dollars that runs through SWIFT every day, and SIPs is a domestic program, so it doesn't fucking matter. And people, if they took 5 minutes to read into these things, they'd understand that like SIPs is not this threat that everybody keeps acting like it is, because you know SWIFT is going to be the dominant system in the financial sector for the foreseeable future.
I think right now it's the highest percentage of global countries using the US dollar in the history of the world. Like it's at an all-time high, and like everyone's like, oh my god, the the market's collapsing and this and that. My aunt said that to me yesterday. She's like, yeah, how do you feel, Mr. Businessman, about a low Dow? I said, the all-time high was like 43,000. We're trading at 40. It's at 41,000 now. Like, what low Dow are you referring to? Like, what are you?
Right.
Like, that's the thing, man. Like, something has to be done. Carr, the FCC guy, I think he's doing a good job. I think he's doing a great job. But something has to be done about the media just posting and promoting and spreading lies. Like,
what do you think?
It's like the she sent me an article last night, yesterday, about the Atlantic article where Trump, what was it, Losers and Suckers hoax?
Yeah, Suckers and Losers about veterans.
Yeah, it was literally in 2020 is when it was written.
Yeah.
And I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, that was disproven. Jake Tapper even said it during the debate that it was disproven multiple times. Right. I know we have the First Amendment, man, but like, you journalists have a right to tell the truth. And when you say that, like, this, that had a massive impact on things. Like, there's a lot of people that believe he said that.
Right.
And
yeah,
he didn't say it. And there's no recourse and there's no punishment for doing things like that that just have a massive impact on society and shape the opinion of Americans, you know. And it's like, this was based on a lie because you hate the person you wrote the article about. Like, there has to be some recourse there. Like, you can't anonymous source. Who's anonymous
Yeah, no, that's
like,
not.
You know what I mean? Like, what does that mean? It's like the thing with the guy in El Salvador. Well, the White House said it was a mistake. Okay, who said that?
Right.
Who said that? Like, tell me who said it.
Could have been some 22-year-old college student that works there, right? As an
intern. No, but there's no name attached to it. It's an anonymous source. So, like, no one said that. Like, the guy's a citizen of El Salvador. He was on an active deportation order. Like, what? Like, is it? And that's the thing that's crazy to me about the Democrats in this cycle. Like, dude, they, like you were saying, let AOC talk. Dude, give her some more, you know, Monster energy drink. Let her rip. Let it rip, girl.
For real.
And like, they lack leadership, and the hill they're dying on is like trying to bring criminals back in the country. Like, and then you have all these activist judges. That's another thing. Something's got to be done about it.
Yeah, district judges.
You can't have a district judge do a coast to coast. That's bullshit.
Nope,
that's like totally when that judge in Hawaii in Trump's first administration did something involving firearms. It was like Obama's college or law school roommate. It's like, bro, you're in Hawaii. I live in Florida. Yeah. You don't get to say anything to me.
I completely agree. No, district judges have way too much power. There is no checks and balance for that. There should not be anything like a national injunction on anything, especially that judge is not even elected. They are an appointed person, and 99.99% of the time they are politically appointed to just be an obstructionist, which is exactly what's going on. And if this was anyone else, right? Let's just say if this was 2 years ago and Biden had a bunch of district court judges coming forward and saying, oh, we're gonna block you and you can't do these things. The Democrats would be saying the same thing. We all agree, right, that there needs to be checks and balances. That system needs to be rewritten. Anybody that has that much power, first off, that's the definition of tyranny. And I think we all agree that that process needs to be redone. You're just not going to get enough people to say that it needs to be redone now just because of Donald Trump being the president.
The best way that I can explain that to anyone listening, the Supreme Court, it takes five of them to have a majority opinion on something. You're telling me that some dipshit in Indianola, Iowa, a district judge, has the authority to do a nationwide injunction. Do you remember the woman in Illinois, the night court judge? She's like a traffic judge.
That sounds familiar.
Put the injunction or like tried to prevent Trump from getting on the ballot in Illinois. It's like,
yes,
ma'am. You listen to Colorado traffic citations. Same thing. What are you talking about?
Exactly. No, there is no recourse for that. There should be. I don't know what you would do. I don't know if you'd have to have, like you said, there's five Supreme Court Supreme Court judges that have to agree. If you need to have a panel of judges to do something like that for national injunctions, I don't think they should have any sort of authority outside of a specific case or the county that they preside in to have any sort of injunction. You want to tell me that your specific county has something going on and you're going to do that? That's fine. That seems like your scope of work, right? Something nationally, not at all. Like you said, Hawaii and Florida, like they're the cultures, the people, all of that is so different. You do not get to say what's good. That's good there is good somewhere else.
Yeah, I think a judge out of Maine did something involving the Texas border, some type of TRO.
Yeah.
It's like,
right?
Do you know why far Maine is from Texas? Right. Like that's case in point, like House, Senate, what are you guys doing? Like, what are you doing? Like, do something.
Very weak Congress something. Right now.
But, you know, that's the thing I learned about D.C., man, is, like, they don't really want change. Like, they're all there.
No.
They're in cahoots. You know, like, they all kind of want the same thing. Like, none of them are going to rock the boat. And they'll talk shit. Like, Nancy Mace, bleh, vomit. And Jasmine Crockett, vomit.
Oh my
like,
God, dude.
Those two make Marjorie Taylor Greene look like a statesman. And I didn't know that was possible.
Right.
Like, oh God. It's like everyone's trying to get their soundbite and like their little 5 minutes of fame so they can. And here's another thing. I will vote and donate money to anyone that can stop those sons of bitches from texting me.
Mm.
Democrat,
oh God.
Progressive, trans, progressive, what non-passable, whatever you are, I will vote for you if you can stop them from spamming me and sending me political stuff on text.
Dude, it's not even just them. Like I got like I think 50 different numbers texts from Ted Cruz, right, during the election, and it's all 99% of them are bullshit. It's somebody trying to spam you because they sent some bad link in there that's going to take your Apple ID password or whatever the hell it is in there too, right? You know, I want to ask you the same question I actually asked Dan Holloway when he was on here. And we were talking about how people are addicted to instant gratification and dopamine hits from their phone. And I told him, I said, you know, when the Constitution was written, it was written for people that don't exist anymore. There was no such thing for the most part as instant gratification, not in the way that we know it today. And the Constitution is purposefully a very small document. It's meant to be ambiguous in ways that, you know, for the three branches to go back and forth on whose power, whose authority this is to try and mitigate having somebody in charge of all of it at the same time. So I'd ask you this, gradual change is the expectation and was the expectation of the founding fathers of the document like the Constitution. For people like Americans today who are used to being addicted to dopamine and instant gratification, how do you sell gradual change in the American government system, or do you think it's even worth it playing that game at all?
That's a fantastic question. Richard Ryan, one of my dearest friends, is writing a book called The Warrior. Well, he's written a book called The Warrior's Guard, and it releases Tuesday. It is about you are asking.
Would love
me.
To talk to him.
Let me make a note.
Would love to do that.
I came with fire. Richard.
Appreciate it.
Ryan. I'm going to get him to send you a copy of the book, and then you need to get him on as a guest to talk about it. The best part about getting older, dude, is you get a lot wiser. And
sure.
I don't have main character syndrome. I've never wanted to be the main character. I've been at Black Rifle for a decade. I wanted to be on camera and in videos and in content, it would have been easy. I chose not to.
Yeah.
I like to help create the news. I don't ever want to be the news.
I love that.
With that being said, I'm a lot more patient than I used to be. And what's going to happen is people are going to get sick of their phones. They are designed to be addictive. Mm. There's a dopamine hit. You ever put your phone down and pick it right back up?
Yeah.
They got your ass. I think eventually people will get sick of it. And I think we're a few years away. Like Instagram was invented as a photo sharing app. I love looking at high quality badass photos. I don't want to look at stupid reels. Otherwise, I'd have a TikTok account. I like photos. I like high res badass images of all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
travel interior design. I like Porsches. I like hunting. I
like those high def photos of the sun. I think those are sick.
I love the whole space, aerospace stuff, like the sun, the moon, like the Milky Way. Like I those photos are so great. But you don't get that shit anymore. It's all some dumb reel or it's a still with a song on it.
Or AI.
Fuck off. I don't want to hear your song. I just want to look at your photo. But I think what will happen is it will swing. And everything comes in cycles. Like I think Instagram, we've been dealing with Instagram now for probably 15 years. I think Instagram's kind of coming to an end, personally. Look what happened to Facebook. People don't use Facebook much anymore.
A Meta product.
Instagram, I think, is kind of going the way of the dodo bird. They have an identity crisis. They're trying to be TikTok. They're not. They never will be.
Right.
Their algorithm isn't strong enough. TikTok will close TikTok before they sell it because they will not give up that algorithm. There's no way. And then you have I think, like, boys don't ask girls out. I think porn is a huge problem. Like,
oh, yeah.
I think I read some study the other day, 40% of like juniors in high school have never asked a girl out on a date.
That's wild.
Yeah, because they don't, like, as a young man, my goal was to go out and hook up with a girl and, you know, make out with them, grab their boobs, stick your hand down their pants. Like, those things happen in stages. Oh, yeah. Like, for the only way you could see, when I was a kid, the only way you could see, you know, tits and badge is finding a stack of Hustler magazines hidden in the woods or something. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And that's not the case now. Grandpa's closet. There is nothing that those kids don't have access to. There's nothing they haven't seen.
Correct.
So that's a huge problem. That's a massive problem. They're not – the alcohol consumption is down drastically. Kids aren't drinking. They're not going to house parties like I did as a kid, which I think that not drinking is a great thing. I think alcohol is horrible for you. Like I said, man, I think it's all cyclical, man. I think these things come in cycles, and I think some cycles, the longer we go, will happen faster, and some cycles will take longer. But I will tell you this. The world that we know today is not going to look like this in 2 years. You look at humanoid robots, you look at the speed at AI and the development, like the humanoid robots thing, that's the next gear. There's a company called Figure AI. So you have Tesla's robots, which are Optimus, and you have Figure AI, which is 1A. I think Optimus is 1B.
Is this a U.S.-based company?
Oh, yeah. Brett Adcock's the CEO, founder. They're out of Silicon Valley, California. San Jose, San Francisco area. They raised $675 million last March on a $2.6 billion valuation. I was an investor in that round.
Awesome.
10 months later, the valuation is $39 billion, and they're raising $1.5 billion on a $39 billion valuation. They spent $100 million during that 10-month period. They're still sitting on all that cash. Nuts. So that's a 15x return in 10 months. But if you look at this, those robots are fully autonomous. Okay? And what they did was they used, like, Meta tried to buy it. OpenAI tried to buy Figure. And Brett said no. And got rid of, stopped using OpenAI and just built their own LLM. And there's some videos out there of them, someone walking up with a bag of groceries. There's two robots in the kitchen. They put the grocery bag on the table. The robots have never seen what's inside the bag. They don't know what – they've never seen any of it. And they start putting things away. And they're moving incredibly slow, you know. But they're putting them where they need to go. And then they come across an apple. And the two robots' heads go like this. And they communicate. And one picks up a bowl with the apple in it and hands it to – the other robot, who takes the apple out of the bowl and puts it in the fridge in the crisper section.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, dude, it's wild. And the thing is, it's like that video is...
What do I do with this?
2 months, not even 2 months old. Maybe it's 2 months old. But, like, I was watching the video, and I invested in the B round. I invested in the C round, which is the latest round. And I was talking to my buddies, like, man, those things move... Or my brother, he was like, yeah, those things move so slow. I said, but think about this, man. That's the shittiest they're ever going to perform. From this day forward, every single day, they will be better than they were the day before. And that, when you look at the global human working capital, it's like an $80 trillion industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you got to think about this from a humanoid robot. And I'll use Kimber when they moved one of their factory from Yonkers, New York to Alabama.
Okay.
And the problem they had in Alabama was people showing up on time, passing drug tests, you know,
right,
doing their job effectively, having a positive attitude, not having problems at home. And what they didn't realize was that a company out of New York coming to Troy, Alabama, and the guy that ran the factory, he was an awesome dude, West Point grad, tanker, just a hard ass, but like squared away guy. And yeah, it's like, first of all, man, you bring a northern accent into the South. The moment I hear someone with a northern accent, I stop and look, because we're distrustful of northerners. We just are. We make a mental note. Hey, is that a Yankee? That's a Yankee in here. You know, you hear it and like you're like very, very tuned into it. So you've got like this hard ass who comes to the South and is dealing with a totally different workforce, and they can't get them to pass drug tests. They can't get them to show up on time. There's a laundry list of problems with people. You have benefits. You have shifts, you have night shift, you have, you know, different shifts. You've got unemployment insurance you got to pay. You've got sick leave. You've got paternity leave. You get all this stuff. Yeah. With a robot, works 20 hours a day.
Yeah.
And you don't have to worry about those problems.
Right.
So Elon Musk said it best. He said, once we get to the point where robots are entering the workforce, in the factories. I think that in-home humanoid robots are a decade away. I believe that. Factory robots are four years, maybe faster.
Mm-hmm.
He said, once the humanoid robots start working in the factories, there is absolutely no stopping it. There's no turning back. You're not going back, and there's nothing you can do to stop it.
Well, let me ask you this then, because we were talking about Rome earlier. Mm-hmm. Rome went to war in Gaul, right, for years, and they brought back a slave force that eradicated the Roman middle class, right? When you look at robots taking over jobs like this, it reminds me of that. There's no unskilled blue-collar labor if you are having robots do all of this, okay? So what do you do with those people whose jobs are going to be replaced, especially when Donald Trump wants to bring manufacturing back to the United States, and the idea is to have American jobs making American products. Like, do you train people how to repair robots, learn how to code, right? Like design weights for LLMs, if you know what I mean by like the weights, you know, for the logic, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So I think you're envisioning a humanoid robot polishing and slide checking, rack checking a Kimber 1911. I think that type of work, that the skilled stuff, is 10 years down the road. But keep this in mind when you think about the sorting of packages. Like, Figure just signed a really big deal with UPS for 100,000 robots. It does not require any skill to sort a package. So just remember this. At Amazon warehouses, there are suicide nets. Second floor, third floor, fourth floor, because people try to kill themselves that work there because they're so miserable. All right?
Yeah.
So there are jobs that robots will be doing that no one wants to do. That's the way I look at it. As far as eradicating the middle class, like NAFTA and Bill Clinton and those guys did everything in their power.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But it's like, you know, Trump, like another thing, like Trump wants to bring back manufacturing. Factories. I love it. I think it's great.
I do too.
I support it. However,
yep.
I'm not working in a goddamn factory. I don't. None of my family's going to work in a factory. Not that there's anything wrong with factory work, but like, we're not leaving what we do to go work in a factory. So that's a challenge because do those people want those jobs back? Or is there a class of people that wants to work in a factory? So if you look at factories, dude, like, you know, in Pittsburgh and Ohio and states like that that had a lot of factory stuff, like there was pride in that job, man. And generationally, decades and different generations of families worked there. And that's what kept these towns going. And there was, you know, a certain pride there, which is awesome. I don't know that we can get that back at the scale that we once had it at. Like, and also, here's the big thing, man. The American consumer gets a vote in that because Americans believe we have a God-given right to cheap gas and cheap airfare, as well as cheap products. Like, in it, like, when you have a company that has shareholders and board members and a major company, when you make X amount of dollars in 2024, guess what you got to do in 2025? It better be higher. And 2026 better be higher than 2025. You have to have year over year growth. And that changes the dynamic of things. So I think they've done, and I don't know that this was intentional. I think this was a byproduct of Bessent kind of getting a hold of this thing after Lutnick and Navarro kind of fucked the whole tariff rollout. They didn't even include Bessent, who's the most talented guy in the whole administration, in my opinion. He's a badass.
I agree with you.
We've isolated China. We have absolutely isolated China. And I think that India has agreed to do a bunch of the stuff that China's doing for us. And, like, we've got a really big mineral deal with India that I believe we signed or about to sign.
Ukraine, too.
Yeah, so isolating China, like, they're just – they're a bad actor, man. Like, why do I have a smart vacuum? What is that shit? Yeah. You know?
It's a spy robot. Yeah. Dude. Like, that's legitimately what it is.
100%. I have smart washer and dryer. Why does that have why does that have a Wi-Fi?
Well, that's like I love that you mentioned this. You're talking about the IoT, right? Internet of Things. All of that is being used to spy on you, absolutely, and having more Chinese products in them. When I was in the Air Force, we learned about a Marine Corps unit who purchased a bunch of laptops from a Chinese company several years prior and had been using them, and they were getting them replenished, and then found out that all of the laptops were bugged. And like, I make it tell you so many stories, of the military that has been purchasing DJI drones, another example, right? Autonomous vehicles is another example, mapping out with GPS, you know, bases and flight lines and all this. It's fucking crazy to me.
It's like, dude, who's in charge? Guys, somebody.
Right.
Now.
Right.
Yeah, something's got to give there with China. It's funny you mentioned the guy that was Niedermeyer. What was his name? That was
Knutson with FDR.
Yeah, Knutson.
Yeah.
You know that China, all of their maritime ships they're all built at military grade, right? Every ship they have, I don't care if it's a sailboat or whatever, it can be flipped.
Oh yeah.
And converted into military grade like immediately. So. That's interesting, but like I think that I still think we live in the greatest country on the planet, man, and like I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world, and like it's just just stop reading the headlines, man. And it'll be interesting, we'll, you know, to take a look in 6 months from now how everything's going and all that. But I think everything's kind of heading in the right direction, you know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see.
Do you think that with a lot of the office work being taken over by artificial intelligence, because you can get an AI to concatenate data a hell of a lot faster than you can some fucking 23-year-old with a bachelor's degree, do you think that a lot of that shift away from it and people who are sick and tired of making spreadsheets would be a generation of people willing to do more labor that way? No?
Shit, no. They don't. Let me ask you this. What year were you born?
87.
God, to be young again. What would happen if we took – I was born in 75. What would happen if we took a bunch of kids from today and sent them back in time to 1988?
Oh, dude.
They would lose their shit. They wouldn't know what to do. And then they'd figure it out, and they'd be like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Riding bikes around all day, drinking out of garden hoses,
bologna sandwiches,
having a blast. Anyway, I lost track of time. I got to get up early. I got BJJ in the morning. I don't mean to cut our show off.
No, you're good.
Immediately, but that abruptly.
No, it's okay. No, I think I guess my last question for you, I guess, do you think that we had this conversation a while back about Gen Z and whether or not they'll be the generation who can turn things around. And if you look online, if you believe what you see online about the return to like this, like trad value working out, they are an incredibly fit group of people for the most part. They have, some of the most information at their fingertips, way more even than millennials did, like my generation. Do you think that they are going to be successful at doing that? Or do you think that a lot of these negative things that we've talked about, the dopamine addiction, the instant gratification, will be too much? I do agree with your postulation that people will get sick of their phones. And I think that we are starting to see proof of what you just said in Gen Z, but I'm curious on your final take on this, and then we can get you out of here.
Girls love muscles, man. Plates make dates. Yeah. And true. when you lift weights, it elevates your testosterone. Look at what's happening with Mark Zuckerberg.
Oh yeah.
Like started surfing, started BJJ, testosterone started increasing. He started doing manly shit. And at the end of the day, man, I don't care what anyone says. Like, they're guys, like, it's in their genetic code, man, to do manly stuff.
And girls like, for the girls.
Emasculating men, I do think this generation, Gen Z, they're going to be like, man, fuck this stuff. They're not going to try to pander to females. Like, I think they'll be able to get girls on their own. And I think they're realizing that, like, there's a lot of fun to be had in the world, like getting outside of doors. And I think they're all kind of sick of technology. Like, they're a huge, huge conservative group in that generation. And they also, I think that's one of Trump's biggest pickups was that age demographic. They just got sick of looking at all these weak-ass men and these annoying women.
Being told they're bad inherently for their whole life.
There is no man on this planet that wants to listen to a woman complain about something. I don't care.
I'm one of them.
Yeah, right here. Same here, man. So, anyway.
Well, Baker, thanks for talking to us, man. I appreciate it. And obviously, for everybody listening, thank you for your time. Thank you for checking out the show. And check out the show notes as well for our sponsors. And we'll catch you on the next episode.
Thanks, dude.